Great to have you along here on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. You know, aside from your house, probably the most expensive thing you buy is your car. And, of course, when you buy your car, you expect that it will work as promised. And when it doesn't, you might need some help from our guest today or someone just like her. Our guest, Susan Griskowiak, is a lead attorney or is lead attorney at the Lemon Law Justice Center based in Brookfield. For more than 25 years, Susan has specialized in automobile warranty and misrepresentation cases. And here to answer your questions and hear your stories as well. You can join the conversation. Have you bought a car only to see it in the shop for months waiting for repairs? Other problems? Give a call. The number 800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or send an email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Susan Griskowiak, welcome. Thanks for taking time to be with us today. Appreciate it very much.
Thanks for having me, Larry.
Your firm, your law firm in Brookfield is called the Lemon Law Justice Center. Maybe give us some background on the center and your role in it.
So I'm the managing attorney or the lead attorney at Lemon Law Justice Center. As you said in my intro, I've been doing strictly lemon law and auto cases for over 25 years now. Primarily, we focus on the lemon law, which applies to new cars. We do handle from time to time other cases involving misrepresentations, maybe related to something that happened in the sale of a vehicle or the failure to disclose something like an odometer situation, things like that.
So the lemon law, I mean, we... All right, we all know kind of when a car or motor vehicle is called a lemon, things immediately come to mind. But there's a legal definition of this, is there not?
There sure is, and there's a difference. There's different laws that apply to different situations. So our state has its own lemon law, as do many states around the country. Ours is a pretty strong one. And it provides that if you have a new vehicle that has problems within the first year after delivery and meets certain repair attempt requirements, as well as the problem itself falling within the requirements of the lemon law, then that allows the vehicle owner to request either a replacement vehicle or a refund.
Okay. And so it applies to automobiles and probably other vehicles as well, types of vehicles, I assume?
So it applies to cars, motorcycles, RVs, or motor homes. It does have limitations in that it does not apply to things like boats, snowmobiles we get a lot of calls on, or fifth wheel or pull behind trailers. Those are not covered. Our state law is unique in that we do cover semi trucks or other heavy duty vehicles like dump trucks. And there's a lot of states where those consumers, unfortunately, have no recourse.
I will tell you a little story. About 25 years ago, I bought a brand new car, brand new. And I went to pick it up and I was going on a trip of about 300 miles. And I thought, okay, this is a good way to break this new car in. So I traded in the other car. So I left my other car and took that car. And things were running okay. But then about 150 miles in, it started to act really kind of funny. And the oil light went on and I stopped and put a quart of oil in, and I was more than halfway there, so I went to the town and went straight to the dealership of that town and said, could you tell me what's going on here? And this is a brand new car, it's only got 300 miles on it. And they said, they took a look under the hood for a second, and then they said, you better drive back to the original dealer. So I drove back to the original dealer, and I think I about every 50 miles I'd have to stop and put in another quart or two of oil. I got back to the dealer and they said, oh my goodness, what's going on? So they I had to cancel what I was doing, of course, on that trip. And they gave me another car to use until they could figure out what was happening. And then they came back and they said, well, here's what happened. When they were building the car, the motor, they got to the motor part, and it's a six-cylinder motor, and so there's three cylinders on one side and three cylinders on the other side. And somebody forgot to put the O-rings in the cylinders on one side. And so the motor was then toast, of course. I don't know how I got back there. Anyway, I said, well, okay, well, give me a new car. And they said, well, no, we're not going to give you a new car. We'll fix the motor, or we'll put in a new motor, a different motor. I said, a new motor? And they said, well, yeah, we'll put in a new motor, and then we'll give it back to you. But I really kind of wanted at that point a new car. Anyway, I didn't argue about it. I had all grumbled, of course, but, you know, they gave me a car to use. I don't know how many weeks later it was, I got the other one back. And to be honest, that car ran perfectly fine for 125,000 miles or whatever when I sold it. But I, you know, when I was thinking about this show today, I wondered, I have to accept that? I mean, it's a defect, for goodness sake. And I wanted to ask you about what defects are you normally see. That's probably not a defect you normally see.
Well, you'd be surprised. we see a lot of different things related to engines. There's a manufacturer who has a widespread recall of their diesel engines. And I got a number of calls on vehicles where it tended to happen on highway trips at highway speeds when they were pulling a trailer. So I got a call from a family that was on spring break in North Carolina pulling a trailer. Family of five got stuck on the side of the road because their engine blew. Another retired couple was pulling a trailer behind their truck in the mountains of Seattle, Washington area. Their engine blew, and you know, it presents a lot of different problems, and it's not always a widespread problem. We do see anything from mechanical type problems like engines and transmissions. Now there's a lot of technology, so we see problems related to sometimes your touchscreen if you have a newer vehicle where that freezes and you lose control of things kind of going off on their own where your tailgate opens when you don't expect it to, doors locking and unlocking, alarms going off, all kinds of different things. It kind of runs the gamut. For the Lemon Law to apply, it just has to be a warranty defect that substantially impairs the use, value, or safety. So some things touch on all three, like your engine situation. Others, you know, it just has to be one of those three.
Okay. So in my case, and this was 25 years ago, I imagine the laws were different then too.
Actually, our law has been around since the 80s, so okay. It actually was stronger 25 years ago because had you reached out to the manufacturer as opposed to the dealer and requested relief under the Lemon Law, you would have had the option of a new vehicle or a refund. And at that time, if they didn't comply and you had to file a lawsuit, you would get double your damages. So if you had a $30,000 car, you'd get $60,000 back if you had to sue them for it. So they were pretty quick to respond. That was a good hammer for consumers to have to use against the car manufacturers. But if you met the requirement of being down for 30 days because of this engine problem, the law was in effect and could have helped you. A lot of times it's taken care of at the dealership level, like your situation was. And the dealer is not part of the Lemon Law. They're the manufacturer's agent. You have to take your car there to get it repaired. But if you ask a dealer for a new car, sometimes they'll trade you out of it and sell you a new one. But the Lemon Law goes back to the manufacturer. They build it, they warranty the car, they're supposed to take care of it. So ultimately, it goes to the manufacturer.
Well, those O-rings, you wonder how that could possibly happen, but I guess somebody took a break, or I don't know what happened. But it was, in my case, it turned out just fine, and they were good to me, and I'd purchased other vehicles from them in the past, so at that point. So how much grace does the dealer get to try to fix a defective vehicle? I mean, you were saying 30 days or something?
So there's a couple ways to qualify. The easiest and most straightforward is if you have the same problem four times and the problem continues, and that's four times within the first year after delivery. So say you took delivery of a vehicle March 5th of 2025. The Lemon Law looks at what happens from then until March 5th of 2026. So just the 1 year period applies. And if you have the same problem four times and it continues, that's one way to meet it. The other way is a little more complicated. It can be down for 30 days or out of service for 30 days for any combination of problems. So you may have a recall problem, a brake problem, a transmission problem, but if you're out of your vehicle and it's out of service for 30 days, that qualifies. There's also a little bit of a twist to that. Sometimes you may take it in and they have to order a part. So you may still have some lights coming on or things happening and it's still drivable, but you're not able to use it the way that it's intended. So that can also qualify, even if it's in your possession, but it's still having problems. That can count towards 30 days as well.
Susan Griskowiak, our guest today, lead attorney at the Lemon Law Justice Center. They're based in Brookfield. It's great to have her with us today as we talk about lemon laws and as relating to automobiles. A question or comment or experience, I hope you'll join in. Number to call, 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. You could email us to talk at WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Taking a look at the Lemon Law today with our guest attorney, Susan Griskowiak, lead attorney at the Lemon Law Justice Center based in Brookfield. And questions or comments, give a call, 800-642-1234. You can email to talk at WPR.org. Kevin in Madison has a question for you. Let's go there. Hi, Kevin.
Good morning, Larry and your guest. It's a pleasure to be on. I think I have a topic that's on target. I purchased a Ford F-350, so it's a larger truck. You know, it's used for carrying stuff. It has flatbed on it. And I bought it completely through photographs, 50-some photographs and two videos. And I'm, you know, I'm actually happy with my purchase. You know, I'm not, you know, but there were things that were not disclosed. You know, needs a brake job, front brake job. Well, it's something I'll do. And they probably didn't have enough undercarriage photos and things like that. I just, you know, I've talked to the company. You know, it also came with one set of keys, which I can't believe, and no manuals of any kind or the jack that goes behind the seat. So any of the, you know, the stuff that would come with the vehicle is gone. And they say that's always the way it is. And I actually don't believe that. But, you know, so anyway, I just throw that out there in the ring and for discussion. I wouldn't call my truck a lemon at all. Actually, I love it. It's a diesel and, you know, I'm a car and truck guy. So it's pretty cool, you know.
But, all right. Well, yeah, but there's things missing that you were kind of expecting to get. Susan, what do you think?
So I guess my first question is, did you purchase it new or used?
Oh, it's used. Oh, yeah, it's a 2013. It's and I purchased it basically for the price of the fabricated aluminum bed that's on the truck. So they kind of threw in the truck in the deal. I love the bed. You know, so, I mean, that's somewhat of an exaggeration, but not that much. You know.
And was it from a dealer or did you buy it from an individual?
I bought it from an auction house. It's a really well-known, it's a construction equipment auction house. It's international presence. I've known about them forever. It was my first time buying with them.
Okay. You know? Okay.
Yeah, so there's different regulations. Auctions are kind of their own breed. They're different than a dealer. And depending on the state where you purchased it, and with all used vehicles, there are certain things that states require them to inspect and disclose. Other things, they don't. I wish that they covered more, but with a used vehicle, the best thing you can do is check the history and follow up with them, make sure that you're asking questions, something like, does it have all the sets of keys that I need? What's the maintenance that's been done on it? A lot of times when you mention something like it needs new brakes, that's not something that's typically covered. However, if there's something that's required to be inspected and disclosed with respect to maybe the engine itself, transmission, some of the major mechanical components, sometimes there's recourse with things like that. The best thing to do is go back to the seller, whomever that is, whether it's a dealer or an auction, and let them know that you're not happy with the purchase, that there's some issue there, and see what they're willing to do to help rectify the situation for you.
Yeah. Yeah, Kevin, interesting call. Thank you so much. Brian in Wausau, we'll go to you. Hi, Brian.
How are we doing today, sir?
Great. Appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
So I got my daughter bought a car from a dealership, a used car, and it was basically nothing but problems ever since she got it. They gave her a Carfax report on it, but the report didn't show. It showed that it had one turbo replaced on it, and it actually had four turbos replaced on it. So she's struggling now. They told her they would put a new engine in it for her. And what they turns out they did is they put a salvage engine in it. So her car had 137,000 miles on it, and the engine that they called a new engine that they replaced it with and turbo actually had 158,000 miles on it. So I guess I'm wondering, what is our recourse on this? I mean, they never told us. They told us it's going to be a new engine. I guess kind of it is a new engine to the car, but it wasn't what we were considering a new engine. Where do we stand with something? Yeah, I know it's a used car, but I mean, still, I feel like they were very deceptive about this to my daughter, and struggling.
Yeah.
So in terms of a used vehicle in Wisconsin, we have something that's the Wisconsin Buyer's Guide. That's kind of like the used vehicle window sticker here in Wisconsin. And that includes a checklist of all the things that are required to be inspected using reasonable care and disclosed to a potential car buyer. So if there's something on that buyer's guide that they indicated did not have a problem, and then you have a problem shortly after the purchase, then you can go back to the seller. It sounds like your daughter did that, and they have a duty to repair it at no charge to you. So unfortunately, there are not a lot of guidelines. I hear a lot about refurbished or salvaged parts being installed. I don't know that there's anything that's technically a violation by replacing an engine in a used car with another used or salvaged engine. There could be things too that if your daughter asks specific questions about the vehicle and someone misrepresented that or lied to her about something verbally, even if it wasn't something that's on the buyer's guide, there is recourse for that. The other option is the DMV for the state of Wisconsin regulates dealers and licenses them. So if there is something that your daughter thinks was misrepresented, you certainly can file a complaint against the dealer with the DMV. There's a section on the DMV's website for used vehicles that explains how you can file a complaint against them.
And as I was thinking about what Brian was talking about, I know how it would work with me. They'd say, well, we're going to put a new engine in. Oh, okay. So I don't get that in writing. I would probably just go along with what they said. And so probably getting stuff in writing gives you at least more of a leg to stand on.
It does, certainly. You can always go back to if there's a lot of times people are talking to their salesman because that's the face that they dealt with, the person who they're familiar with at a dealership. But I always recommend talking to the general manager, taking it to a superior at the dealership because they want to have happy customers, especially these days when we've got so much available online and so many comments and reviews can be put out there. They want to try to keep people happy, so they may be willing to take an extra step for you too.
Yeah. But in Brian's case, probably worth filing a complaint or?
It certainly is. If they're not satisfied and they think that the dealer was not honest with them about this vehicle or what they were going to do to try to rectify the situation. And, you know, I always recommend that if you're not happy and you're concerned about how they treated you, because you're probably not the only one. And it's best to get them on the state's radar if they're doing this regularly to consumers.
And so in his case or anybody else's case with the same sort of situation, you go to the DMV, Division of Motor Vehicles for Wisconsin.
Yes, correct. And there's a section on their website about used vehicles that talks about how to file a complaint against a dealer. You file the complaint, provide some documents and information, and they have investigators that will reach out to both you and the dealer and make a determination about what happened. And sometimes they can help rectify things, so you don't necessarily need a lawyer.
Yeah, yeah, that's a good next step, sounds like to me, Brian. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. And you can join in, by the way. Number to call, 800-642-1234. You can email to talk at WPR.org. Bob's in Stoughton and has a question. Let's go there. Bob, hello.
Yeah, hello. I bought a 2018 Elantra. And it's only got about 70,000 miles on it, and it's beginning to burn about 2 quarts of oil. And between an oil change, they say the oil changes should be every 7,000 miles on this vehicle. And I've tried to use mostly synthetic oil, and they have it always changed at the dealership, but many times they put in synthetic blend, even though I asked for synthetic. But I'm wondering, is that normal for a car to burn that much? They're telling me it is. But I know that on this same engine some years ago, they had a recall on it and put new engines into Elantras, and I thought they probably had the problem fixed. But
and you bought this from a dealer?
Yes.
Okay. All right.
So, you know, in terms of burning oil, all the manufacturers have their own guidelines in terms of oil consumption and, you know, how much is acceptable and within their guidelines. If you're aware that there was a prior recall related to the vehicle, you can certainly follow up with the National Highway Transportation and Safety Administration. Their website is nhtsa.gov. And there may be something, sometimes with recalls, there's an extended warranty that goes along with it. So there may be something that's available to you through the manufacturer if there was indeed a recall.
So that was, again, that was nhtsa.gov is where Bob should go online.
Yes, they're the ones who handle recalls and oversee to make sure that recalls are completed on vehicles and that they're done within a reasonable time by the manufacturer when there's something that merits a recall on your vehicle.
Bob, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Suzanne, here's a different kind of question. I don't know if we're going to be able to handle this one, but she's wondering if the state's lemon laws apply to microwaves. She bought a brand new one about 8 years ago, and the handle fell off, couldn't be replaced, so she replaced it with another one of the same brand, unfortunately, and the handle fell off that one, too. They glued it back on, but each time I look at the DIY fix, I get angry all over again. Neither the store nor the company cared about my problem and just do microwaves. Is there a lemon law for those kinds of things?
So what we do have, Larry, is a federal warranty law. It's called the Magnuson-Moss Warranty Act, and it applies to any consumer item, any household goods. So a microwave would fall within that. So any household good that comes with a warranty and costs more than $10. So there is recourse. The difficulty in having attorneys try to help you in a situation like that is, even though it's a fee-shifting statute where the manufacturer has to pay the attorney's fees and costs, it's hard for attorneys to get paid on those type of things. You do have recourse and can use that law in a small claims case where you can get up to $10,000 and you don't need a lawyer. But technically, microwaves, we have on occasion done refrigerators and some other appliances that get a little pricier to try to hold the manufacturers accountable.
And it's the Magnuson-Moss
Warranty Act.
Warranty.
And that's a federal law that was enacted back in the 70s that applies to any consumer product that costs $10 or more and is covered by a warranty.
So, yeah. So if you're, you know, you got a $350 microwave, you're probably not going to get an attorney involved in that because it's not going to make any money for the attorney, and it's going to be probably more of a hassle for you then. But so in her case, maybe take a look at the law, or what would you...
Yeah, she can take a look at the law, and this is the type of thing where sometimes class actions come out of it because it may not be beneficial to have an individual action, but if you're not the only one who's having it, and it sounds like the type of problem that is maybe a design problem and everyone's going to have it, they still should be held accountable, but that's where class actions can kind of give some teeth to the laws.
Susan Griskoviak, attorney Susan Griskoviak, our guest today, lead attorney at the Lemon Law Justice Center based in Brookfield. Questions for her, comments, or maybe an experience to share, you can join in. The number to call, 800-642-1234. Email to talk at WPR.org. You mentioned out of service, and does that... How long again? I think you mentioned it. Out of service applies. All right, you can't use it.
Right. So out of service under our state lemon law, it can be a couple of different ways to get to that. It's 30 days out of service to qualify under the lemon law, and that's 30 days within the first year after delivery. It may be, and I see a lot of times these days where your car is just sitting at the dealership because it can't safely be driven while they're trying to get repairs performed or waiting on parts. There can be situations where if you have a problem with your vehicle that affects the use or the safety of it, and you've brought it into the dealership, but they cannot get it repaired and tell you it's okay for you to keep driving it, this is not going to harm anything. So you may bring it in on September 1st and report the problem. They diagnose it, they order a part, and the part may be on back order or just take some time to get there. So they may not call you until October 15th, 45 days later, to actually do the repair and have the part. So even if you've had your vehicle that whole time period, it's still not operating as designed and it's not operating as intended. So even though it's in the consumer's possession, if it took more than the 30 days to finally get it repaired, that also qualifies as out of service under the lemon law.
Okay. So you need to be a little particular about this. I mean, as a consumer, if you go in and it's April 1st, April Fool's Day, let's say, you note that or note that conversation and whatever was said in the conversation, and you hang on to that. Unlike me, or unlike I, who never think to do that, but it's really something you'd have to should do.
Sure. And if you make an appointment and take it in, you'll have documentation from that, and the dealer will have records also. In today's world, with texts and emails, we can certainly track things a little bit better and get things from the dealership and documentation and follow up to a repair visit. Even if they don't give you paperwork, you're able to reach out to them and have a paper trail still through text or email.
And the DOT, and I think you got at this a little bit, but somebody's wondering, you know, the DOT, Department of Transportation, that they license and they regulate motor vehicle industry in the state. And the handling of disputes, will they handle disputes over vehicle sales and repairs under warranty?
They don't get involved directly with lemon law. On occasion, people may reach out to them and they may contact a manufacturer if it's an unrepresented consumer. But I think more often than not, they may tell you you've got to handle it on your own or reach out to an attorney. They don't get heavily involved in lemon law. In terms of problems with repairs or the sale of used vehicles, that's something that they'll do more investigating in.
Yeah. So when does a buyer with a complaint need to hire somebody like you and, you know, an attorney and pursue private litigation?
So with the Lemon Law, we have a pre-suit period. You have to provide the state-required form directly to the manufacturer. You don't need an attorney to do that, and there are a lot of people that I end up representing who try it on their own and try to resolve things directly with the manufacturer. At that point, if they're not able to reach a resolution or the manufacturer denies it, that there is a legitimate claim, that's the time to reach out to an attorney. If you think that you qualify under the Lemon Law, you probably do, and it's definitely worth talking to an attorney. It doesn't cost you any money to reach out and just see if you qualify or not and if someone can help you. The good part of our state law is once you have that pre-suit requirement met and you have to file a lawsuit against the manufacturer, you don't have to pay the attorney's fees and costs. The manufacturer does, because you've given them the opportunity to do the right thing, and they haven't for whatever reason. And if you're forced to just file a lawsuit at that point, then they're responsible for paying the fees and costs, not you.
So your fees are an attorney's fees are recovered through that. But the person who's filing under that circumstance then is not responsible for fees for that.
That's correct, yes.
Okay. So that sounds like not a bad deal.
It's a consumer protection law, so that's the idea.
And, an attorney's going to tell you. I mean, you're going to get a free conversation with the attorney, and they're going to say, well, this is not, I see what you've got, and this is not enough to make it fly. What if that happens?
It does happen sometimes. You know, if I am contacted by someone and they don't qualify under our state Lemon Law, there is the Magnuson-Moss Act that we talked about earlier. That applies to cars and applies to the whole warranty period. Sometimes if neither of those laws apply, there might be somewhere else that an attorney can refer you to so that you can get some kind of assistance or recourse.
Yeah, and we're not talking about cheap here. I mean, something that's a car. I mean, the car I've got, I bought like 12 years ago, and I'm sitting on 140,000 miles or so on it. But if I had to go and replace that car with a new one, and I bought it new, it would be substantially more. And I thought at the time I bought it, I thought it was too expensive, but I bought it anyway. And we're talking $60,000, $80,000, $100,000 for a car. That's a lot of money.
It sure is. And a lot of times now, I see cars that it costs what a house should cost, even over $100,000 for certain types of vehicles. But yeah, I mean, it's a huge expense to the average consumer. And that's why we have the law, because it should work and you put a lot of hard-earned money into it.
Our guest today, Susan Griskowiak, a lead attorney at the Lemon Law Justice Center in Brookfield. Great to have her with us today. Questions for her? Maybe you got an experience of your own you want to share. The number to call, 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you along today. Coming up at noon, we'll talk about scams being reported to the Wisconsin Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection. We'll talk to Michelle Reinen back with us once again. She's administrator of the DACAP Division of Trade and Consumer Protection. Just a personal note, a big thanks to everyone who contributed during our winter member drive. We finished it up yesterday, and it was a big success. And a big thanks to you for joining in and kicking some money in and helping us reach our goal, and actually even exceeded our goal by a bit. So that's wonderful, and I really, really, really appreciate your support during the show and all the shows. Right now, we're taking a look at the Lemon Law with our guest, Susan Griskowiak, lead attorney at the Lemon Law Justice Center based in Brookfield. Again, you can join us at 800-642-1234. Email to talk@WPR.org. Let's go to John in Sun Prairie. John, thank you for calling.
Yeah, if you had a problem with the vehicle and it may or may not qualify, or you have a case open under the Lemon Law and you have a payment on the vehicle or RV or whichever it might be, are you still required to keep paying as you go through the legal process?
Oh, good question.
That is a good question, John. Yes, you are required to keep making your payments. So if you have a loan or a lease on your vehicle, that involves a third-party financial institution. And we mentioned earlier, the Lemon Law applies to the manufacturer. So the manufacturer is responsible. And the biggest reason that you want to keep making your payments and stay current, I mean, one, to protect your credit, but the biggest reason is that if the manufacturer accepts your demand under the Lemon Law, you need to have the vehicle to return it to the manufacturer. If you are not making payments and end up in a repossession situation, you can't fill your piece of the Lemon Law, your end of the bargain, where you have to give the car back. So unfortunately, even if it's sitting on a dealer's lot somewhere, you have to keep making your payments and stay current on it.
No. And that leasing, so if you're leasing, is that kind of considered the same as owning it under the Lemon Law?
There's different processes and different remedies, but it is still covered. So if you're leasing a vehicle, you don't actually own it, but you still aren't stuck with it. If you have a 3-year lease and you have problems 6 months into it, you're not stuck. You can bring a claim under the Lemon Law. You will, as a lessee, get back your down payment on the vehicle and the monthly payments you've made, and the manufacturer will have to terminate the lease and buy the vehicle from the lessor so that the title can be branded as a lemon. If you own the vehicle or you have a loan on it and you've actually purchased it, then you have your option of a replacement vehicle or a refund.
In an email, John wonders, is the Magnuson Moss warranty ad different from the, or how is it different from the Wisconsin Lemon Law?
That's a good question. So the Lemon Law in our state applies only to new vehicles and the first year after delivery, and has to be for a problem that substantially impairs the use, value, or safety of the vehicle. And you have to make it available for repair 4 times and the problem continues, or the vehicle is out of service for 30 days. Magnuson Moss applies to the entire warranty period. Also applies to used vehicles. So you may buy a 2024 vehicle that's still under a manufacturer's warranty and then start having problems. So then you would qualify for relief under Magnuson Moss. It's a little looser than our Lemon Law. It just says your vehicle has to be repaired within a reasonable time. It's a lower burden in terms of the type of problem. It just has to be a condition or defect. It doesn't have to meet the use, value, safety test. And, you know, it allows you to recover damages. Sometimes that can be a buyback. It's rarely a new vehicle, but more often than not, you would keep the vehicle and the warranties would stay in effect and just get a cash settlement for the diminished value, your loss of use of the vehicle, things like that.
Yeah. So Wisconsin also has laws to protect, if I'm not mistaken, consumers from fraud and misrepresentation by sellers of products such as cars. Do you pursue dishonest car dealers, I'm wondering, on behalf of buyers?
I do from time to time. We have less time for that because our Lemon Law and Magnuson Moss cases keep us pretty busy. If there is a case that is a really egregious violation by a dealer, then I may jump in. Things like an odometer fraud situation where I've come across cases where a vehicle may have originally been manufactured for Canada and the odometer is reading in kilometers. Somehow it makes its way to the States and gets changed out to read mileage, but that's not disclosed. That can void warranties and cause some real serious problems for consumers. So we would pursue a dealer for a violation of something like that, or if there's something that's not properly disclosed on the Wisconsin Buyer's Guide and the dealer's refusing to assist the consumer and repair the problem at no charge to them, we may get involved there. There are definitely laws that cover those situations. They can be a little more complicated.
Yeah. What is the legal requirement for a dealership to tell you in terms of telling you the facts about the car that they're trying to sell and problems it may have?
So with a used vehicle, there's the Wisconsin Buyer's Guide that is required by the state to be provided to the purchaser of a used vehicle. Prior to selling the vehicle, the dealer has to do a reasonable care inspection of certain components, the major mechanical components like the engine, transmission. They also have to make sure that other things on the vehicle are legal before it can be sold. It is possible for a dealer to sell you a used car that has problems, but they have to tell you so on the Wisconsin Buyer's Guide, and that has to be clearly disclosed on the buyer's guide, and you have to be aware of that before you purchase a vehicle.
And I think I read somewhere where there can be on the sticker or whatever, as is, the term as is, which would give me pause. When do they put as is, or you know, under what circumstances?
I think every used car that I've seen has been sold as is. The important piece to that is it's as it's represented to you.
Okay.
So the buyer's guide, they will often check the box for as is. On the purchase contract, they will often check the box for as is. But if they are telling you that there is no problem with the engine in the vehicle on the Wisconsin Buyer's Guide, and in fact, there is an engine problem or a transmission problem, whatever the situation is, if they've told you there's nothing wrong, and in fact, there is, even if it's sold to you as is, you still have recourse because they have misrepresented the condition of the vehicle to you.
Yeah, because they would have to be checking that, yeah, in order to, yeah, understood. Kathleen in Green Bay, what's on your mind?
Hi, Larry. I had called previously when you had a service manager guy on, a retired service manager, about my daughter's 2016 Kia, which has excessive oil consumption, and there's a problem with that engine. It's been recalled on other models. The problem continues. We finally got the dealership to agree to this oil consumption testing, but it showed in the last testing that, yeah, it was way under, after 1,000 miles after an oil change, it was low by like a quart and a half or whatever. But the car continues to act erratically. It shakes. It won't accelerate. We take it in. It sits there for a week or more. They say, oh, now it's the catalytic converter. I pay $1,700. It's still not fixed. After that, it's the spark plugs. So we're doing this oil consumption test, but I noticed they've overfilled the oil, so I don't think we're going to get an accurate read the next time we have to bring it in over 1,000 miles. And we're just at our wits' end. We don't know what to do at this point.
And that was with a dealer, right, Kathleen?
Dealer, yeah, in Green Bay.
Okay.
So one thing I would suggest, if you're noticing that the dealer has overfilled it, and normally an oil consumption test, you're there multiple times, I would ask to be there when they're filling it and see the dipstick. And if it's overfilled, get the service manager involved, because that shouldn't be happening. I understand why they're doing it, as you said, probably to make it seem like it's consuming less oil. But you have a right. It's your vehicle, especially if you're paying for it. You have a right to make sure that they're doing this correctly. It should not be overfilled. It should be full, but not beyond that. So you have a right to make sure that that's done correctly. And you certainly should reach out to the manufacturer directly. Just call their customer service number and let them know about the ongoing problems and the concerns and the fact that you believe it should have been included in a recall maybe. But the manufacturer can approve covering some of these repairs or expenses for you as well. So it doesn't hurt to reach out to the manufacturer directly as well.
What's the best way to do that?
I always suggest, starting with just calling the 800 number. A lot of them will open a case. You can ask for assistance with repairs. You can ask for things to be covered and paid for by the manufacturer if they're ongoing. You could even ask them for a buyback, and sometimes they will escalate that and get involved in that situation. There's a lot of different remedies that they can offer you. A lot of them want to make sure that you're a happy customer, They don't always take care of you. That's why I end up suing them a lot of the times. But sometimes you're able to get some kind of recourse out of them when you maybe don't fall under one of the laws here.
Yeah. I was thinking of my own experience. It wasn't with a car. It was with a stove I bought, and it had a warranty. I forget what it was. And a week after the warranty was over, the stove broke, and the local place where I had purchased it from wouldn't do anything for me. So I called the regional office in Chicago and talked to somebody there, and they called the local office, the local place, and then I got a new stove. So sometimes it does pay to go up the chain, as you say, and maybe get some help that way. Yeah. Kathleen, does this all help?
Yes, it does. Thank you.
All right.
Thank you. We're not eligible for Lemon Law. I did a return on a car years ago with the Lemon Law, and it works great for those of you who try to use it.
Thanks, Kathleen. Appreciate your questions and your comments very, very much. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. If you'd like, you could email to talk@wpr.org. Always love to hear from our listeners. Keith and Kiwani, we'll go to you. Hi, Keith.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I just want to put in a plug for electric cars. I'm hearing all these problems, and I'm old, so I've had a lot of problems with cars, too. But I've had two all-electric cars now. There's just way less mechanical moving parts. They're simple. They are efficient. They're cheaper. My electric car a gasoline-powered car would have to get, 80 to 100 miles per gallon to be as efficient as my electric car. And they're great things. So I just want to put in that plug and get rid of the problems you have with the gasoline, the brakes, regenerative braking, so your brake pads don't wear out. I mean, the list goes on and on and on.
Keith, thank you very much for calling. Now, having Keith said that, have you had experiences involving all electric vehicles, Susan?
I sure have, Larry. I wish that all these people had the experience that Keith had with his. There have been some major recalls on electric vehicles with their batteries, some widespread problems, and even some vehicles that catch on fire because the battery gets too hot or has other problems. So I see a lot of them. And, you know, I won't say that it's the majority of my caseload, but I have a heck of a lot of them. So they're not problem-free. They just have different problems than a traditional gas-powered vehicle.
You know, I want to go to one little thing that I noticed in my readings, and that has to do with purchasing. And that has to do with the purchase contract that people, because we always think, well, we've got that 3-day cooling off period that, you know, when you purchase, you can cancel after 3 days. That ain't true. I did not know that.
It definitely is not. We do have an unusual provision in the law. If it's an off-site sale, so they used to do back in the day at what's now American Family Field, but when it was County Stadium, sometimes dealers would have something there at State Fair Park. If it's an off-site purchase, you do have a cancellation period. But if you go to a car dealer in Wisconsin and you buy a vehicle, it is yours as soon as you sign the contract, even if you don't take it home that day. So that is really something to be mindful of. Don't sign on the dotted line unless you really are committed to buying that car.
So read that contract carefully. Think that, oh, I can read that at my leisure. I've got 3 days. No, you do not if you buy it directly from the dealer. On that happy note, Susan, thanks so much for being with us today. I hope we can do this again. Appreciate it very much. Thank you.
Thank you, Larry.
Susan Griskowiak, lead attorney at the Lemon Law Justice Center based in Brookfield, Wisconsin. My jaw dropped when I saw that about those contracts. Coming up, speaking of contracts and other things relating to consumer issues, None other than Michelle Reinen of the Department of Ag, Trade, and Consumer Protection will be with us next to answer your questions and talk about some spring things relating to consumer frauds as well. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. You know, last year, the state received more than 20,000 calls to its consumer protection hotline, and the calls included a lot of complaints about attempted scams to steal money and personal information from Wisconsin residents like you and like me. Talk about some of those scams today with Michelle Reinen, administrator of the Division of Trade and Consumer Protection within our Wisconsin Department of Ag, Trade, and Consumer Protection. And as we move along, I hope you'll join the conversation. What's going on with scams in your area? Give us a call. The number 1-800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. Or you can send an email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Michelle Reinen, welcome back. Good to see you.
Well, great to be here, Larry. Thanks for having me back.
I tell you what, we've got all kinds of things always going on. There's an employment scam that's going on that I thought was terrible. Your agency receives reports of employment scams in the form of fake jobs, and often for online or remote work. What's going on? What happens to these cases?
Yeah, as we know, there are multiple online platforms that really allow employers to post job listings and then potential employees to search for those job opportunities. And while most of those activities on these websites are legitimate, sometimes those scammers, they're breaking the rules and they post convincing but fake position openings. So then the job seeker may go through this extensive interview, hiring, and onboarding process, and they even start working in their new position only to find out they've been scammed and the job is not real and their money or personal information was stolen by that scammer. So in this case, fake hiring scams are for online remote work, as you mentioned, which allow that scammer to really cast that really wide net of interested parties, and they try and pull in the people, as many people as possible. The job might involve either a simple or a highly specialized work. It can offer flexible hours, surprisingly good benefits, and very unusual high pay. The employer asks for sensitive information like a social security number to be sent to them through unsecure communications like a text message. You know, we'd never send that number that way. In many cases, then the scammer or the employer will send the new hire a check to set up their office, but they require you to use a specific vendor. They ask you to buy a laptop, a printer, and all the other gear, but this check is fake. And the vendor is really part of the whole scam because it's an account or website controlled by the scammer. So that consumer can spend hundreds of thousands of dollars on fake office equipment that will never show up. That check bounces that they received. So then they end up having spent all their own money on these fake office supplies that will never show up.
That's awful. I mean, you know, people are looking for a job and they think, oh, I've got this great job and I just have to spend a little money to get. Have you caught any? I mean, I'm sure that you've gotten complaints about it, obviously, or we wouldn't be talking about it.
We have received reports about it. It's happening nationally. We're trying to track the money backwards. But of course, that gets very complicated because of the fake checks and the way these scammers hide. So we're working with all our partners on these situations. And really, I think what we need to be sure is that job seekers are alert to this and they're using caution. So don't respond to unexpected texts or click on unknown links. I mean, that's not part of the job seeking process. Most legitimate employers are not going to text a job seeker out of the blue about a great opportunity to hire them. They'll go through the email process, the resume, the application screening process. And then practice caution. Even when using a legitimate job seeking platform or website, lying is against these rules, but scammers don't care about the rules. I mean, we know that in the days of telemarketing fraud. Research the employer. Always be looking at the who you want to be employed by, because scammers are going to promise those big rewards for little work, but they don't provide a lot of information. And when you search online for the name of the company, use words like review and scam and complaint and see what pops up, because others are going to report on this. And then the other big thing is avoid that high pressure tactics. Scammers want consumers to act really quick before they get a chance to really think through anything or talk to others about it. They might use threats. They might try and provide incentives to convince you that you need to take this immediate action in order to seal the deal on the job. And we all know that an ideal job can be really hard to come by. And many job seekers who want that ideal job, they're going to be eager to find that perfect opportunity, but still use your gut. If it's too good to be true, we need to recognize those red flags and warning signs and use caution.
Yeah, makes good sense. Ron in Baldwin has something for us. Let's go there. Ron, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. I had a message on an answering machine that I had my account had $134, and they wanted to know if that was true or not, or if that was right. And then they said, call the number on your answering machine. And I thought that was suspicious, so I didn't do it. And I called my credit card company, and they said that was right what I did, that you don't, they never do that. They never would, you know, like I just thought it was suspicious to call the number on your, you know, answering machine. So,
Ron, you were a smart guy, I think. So Ron went to his credit card and used that number.
Excellent choice. I love it. It's a great story. That's exactly right. I mean, the scammer is going to tell you to use the phone number that they're going to leave so you can verify the account or the information. There's all sorts of different scams that could stem from there in doing verifications or saying yes. So whenever you question something about a message you receive, use your own contact information. Take that credit card, flip it over, find that utility bill or that credit card statement and use the number on that. That was wonderful.
Yeah, Ron, thanks for calling with that, with your experience and that tip. That's great. You can call in to 800-642-1234 or email to talk@wpr.org. Your department receives reports from consumers whose online social media or maybe their email accounts have been taken over by a hacker or a scammer. How common is that problem?
Oh, this is more and more common. Actually, the identity theft category for 2025, a majority of it was about reports of online account takeovers. So just imagine getting a message from a friend asking you to support a local cause, or receiving an official-looking notice from a financial institution about a compromised account, or simply making an online purchase from a trusted business. What all these situations have in common is that they could all be account takeover scams. So we need to practice caution here, because that's a form of identity theft, and it is growing in nature. So we receive these reports from consumers who've had their accounts taken over by scammers and hackers. They're losing access to the social media or email account. That, one, can be alarming, and two, can be frustrating, because maybe it interferes with your business. You might need those accounts in order to function during the day. But you can also lose access to your financial accounts, and that can be devastating. and hard to recover from. So certainly be cautious here. Scammers gain access to online accounts through phishing attacks, social engineering, malware, data breaches. And then once that account has been accessed, scammers might use it to steal your personal information and financial information and transfer money from your account to that scammer. They might try and blackmail individuals. They may also use the social media account to contact your friends and family and other group members that you belong to further a scam, appearing as though they are you. And then they can also gain access to your email, your social media, loans, and bank accounts if you have direct logins to these other things through that account that you have had compromised there. So we need to practice a lot of caution there when sharing information online, because that's one of the ways that they gain that access to take over those accounts.
And how do you protect those accounts? I mean, what should we do to make sure that we're protected?
Well, change passwords regularly. Don't share information online, like the little details about your pet's name or your family member names or past school attended. Those are usually security questions. So if a scammer has one piece of information and now you've posted online the other pieces of information that they use, we're making it easier for them. And then you need to monitor accounts regularly. And if you see something suspicious, you need to take action about it. And then a simple step is to use bookmarks and favorites to navigate to commonly used websites, because that will keep us from clicking those links to navigate to those imposter websites where we would be logging in and just handing over our credentials to the scammer through that fake website.
Annette in Tisk Mills has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Annette.
Good morning, or good afternoon, actually, by now. Yeah, I get 3 or 4 phone calls every single day from people who are going to help me pay my tax bill. And as I told your screener, the most insidious part about this is that they ask you to press 9 to opt out. So how many people do that and then make themselves recognizable as, you know, it's a real person then. So they're just going to keep calling and calling and calling. But I've been getting these calls, I bet 3 or 4 months already, 3 or 4 a day. It's just ridiculous.
Huh. Thanks, Annette, for calling. Michelle, a comment.
Yeah. Well, one, I'm really glad that Annette's recognized that don't press any buttons to get off any lists or confirm anything, because that does put you on lead generation lists where you're going to get more and more calls. And then there are those scams out there right now. They're out there year round, but they're heightened right now because we are in tax season. So whether they're helping you to pay your taxes, or maybe it's related to you owing back taxes, there are another number of scams out there where they are really trying to entice consumers to take action. And they're using very key buzzwords like Tax Resolution Oversight Department, Tax Mediation and Resolution Agency. They're doing tax resolution, a tax resolution officer's contacting you. It could be an IRS liability reduction program. They're conducting red flag checks. I mean, all the buzzwords that are going to get us excited, concerned, and thinking that this could be something legitimate, where this is our one opportunity to respond in order to resolve something. So if you think you have a tax situation, take a breath and go to the IRS at irs.gov or go to the Department of Revenue at revenue.wi.gov. And you can seek out information in order to contact them directly to have a conversation about your own unique tax situation to see if you owe back taxes, or they may have a payment program in order to help you pay your taxes. But no one's going to call you out of the blue to provide this assistance.
Our guest today, Michelle Reinen, Administrator of the Division of Trade and Consumer Protection within our Wisconsin Department of Ag, Trade and Consumer Protection. Great to have her back with us. She always has great information for us. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Talking consumer scams today with Michelle Reinen, Administrator of the Division of Trade and Consumer Protection. It's here for Wisconsin. It's always great to have her with us. And callers online, let's go to the phones again. Mike in Madison, it's your turn. Thank you, Mike, for calling.
Well, good afternoon. My question is regarding some Bitcoin stuff. I did have a Coinbase account with a bunch of Bitcoin, and I got locked out of it. And I have not been able to get back in. I've tried everything, and I've gotten scammed a few times with fake websites and fake numbers trying to get this. And now I'm getting all these phone calls and mailings saying, supposedly represented by lawyers, that they can get me my funds back. But I'm getting probably, three or four mailings a week and five or six phone calls a week now about this. And I'm wondering if that is a scam or if some of these are legitimate lawyer things. I would like to get my Bitcoin back, and I've tried everything through the actual Coinbase site, but I can't talk to an actual human being. But now I'm getting just inundated with mailings and calls about how to get this
taken
stuff
care
back
of.
Out of a quote.
Yeah.
Taken care of it. I don't know if it's real. I know some people actually do this for a living, but I don't know what. And, today's day and age, I don't know what to trust anymore.
Yeah. Michelle?
Yeah, well, I'd say first, it's odd that they would know out of the blue that you're having trouble in order to solicit you and send these mailings and things. So I'd practice caution there. I would recommend that you actually file a complaint with a Wisconsin Department of Financial Institutions. Their security program works on scams and schemes related to cryptocurrency and cryptocurrency fraud issues. Now, you legitimately controlled your wallet and purchased Bitcoin, and now you're frozen from it, but they may also be able to assist in navigating that and figuring out these different mailers and tracking that. Outside of your situation, I will say for everyone else listening that cryptocurrency has been tied as a payment method. I should say 90% of cryptocurrency transactions have been tied to scams and fraud based on a report out of the state of Iowa and the U.S. Department of Justice, the District of Columbia. So usually payment by cryptocurrency indicates a scam or a fraud. This situation's a little reversed in that it appears that Mike had the Bitcoin, purchased it, wasn't trying to pay a bill or do a transaction, has been locked out. But now the scam might be coming on the backside with the lockout. So again, the Wisconsin Department of Financial Institutions would be the agency to file that complaint with and see if you can get some assistance in navigating this.
Now, this may not be in Mike's situation, but I could see where somebody could buy Bitcoins from, and they're not really buying it, they're buying it from some kind of scammer, and then the scammer then could control it and say, block it, and then charge you to try and get your money back, and then take that money too.
Absolutely, because they may have set up, directed you to a false website as to where to purchase it, and then they may encourage you to buy more and more because they're showing your gains are so good, but that they won't let you have access to those earnings. That is a whole scheme in itself, a different kind of investment scheme, and usually it starts with a out-of-the-blue contact or a romance or an investment coach situation through some social media site. So yes, Larry, that is an excellent example of something that could happen.
And so in Mike's case, if you just click in Wisconsin Department of Financial Institutions, the information should come up that would lead him to contact within that.
Yes, looking for a .org, or I'm sorry, a .gov ending there to make sure you're at the department, the State Department site. And if at all else, you can always contact Consumer Protection and the hotline will direct you there. And that Consumer Protection number is 800-422-7128. If you file a complaint with us, we'll direct it over there. And you can do that at datcp.wi.gov.
Mike, there you go. Thank you very much for calling. Let's turn to Rich in Galesville. Rich, hello.
Hi there.
What's on your mind?
Well, I don't know if you've covered this before I turned you on, but I'm curious about antivirus internet security companies you can subscribe to that are supposed to find all your information that's out there where it doesn't belong and get it deleted. Are they any good? Do they actually do what they say?
Hmm. Michelle, are there companies out there that are will work in your best interest? Let's put it that way.
There are certainly companies out there that promote that they will monitor your digital identity. You need to hand them your personally identifiable information in order for them to do that monitoring. So you're going to want to check that company out closely to see if they've had complaints, how they're going to handle your information and store it securely in order to do that monitoring. And then, depending upon what you're paying for, what are they going to do to clean it up? How do they approach that, and how responsive are they to that? Or do they just notify you and leave it to you to clean that information up? So you're always going to want to check a company out that you're going to do business with and make sure you're going to be comfortable with that. There's lots out there. There's lots of options. But know that you're going to have confidence in their privacy policies because you're going to be handing over your information to them.
All right, Rich, something to think about there. Thank you very much for calling. Ken in Appleton, we'll go to you next. Hi, Ken.
Hi, how are you today, Larry?
Great, appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
Okay, thanks for having me on. Yes, about 2 weeks ago, my wife was checking her Amazon account. We hadn't ordered anything, and she almost went into tears, and she's seen that there are orders coming over the next 3 or 4 days. And she asked me, did you order this air bleeder for brakes? I says, no. And then she mentioned a couple other things. I says, no. And so she followed up, tried to get a phone number to call and talk to somebody at Amazon. We had to search on the web to find a phone number because otherwise you have to text them and we want some immediate response. And they said that they would take care of the ones that were coming up, but we should cancel our charge card number. And we called the bank and they said, you know, that we canceled the number on that account. But how worried should we be that this could happen in the future, even if we put another credit card number on that Amazon account?
It's a great question. It's hard to tell because we don't know exactly what happened or how they gained access. So I'm hopeful that Amazon provided some tips and recommendations on trying to make your login more robust to lock down your account. But I certainly would change your passwords. If they offer multi-factor authentication, set that up so it's a two-step to log in so someone else can't just act as you on your account, and continue to monitor that account for activity. If you have any auto logins through apps, I would probably disconnect those and cut those off, not knowing the source that was used in order to gain access and have that account takeover. But I also think changing that credit card number was a great step in order to try and stop the activity as well.
Yeah. Yep, makes sense. Ken, thank you, and good luck. Liz in Delavan, your turn. Hi, Liz.
hello, and thank you for the show. I just want to say that I was on my smartphone, my Android, and I did a lot of these little videos and articles that pop up. And lately, sometimes I've been getting them without any buttons to press to save them or send them. But anyway, I pressed on one I wanted to put into my Gmail account, my email, and it didn't really have any way to do that. But I pressed something, and then it showed a screen that looked legit that had you had to press your choice. Do you want to send it text? Do you want to send it email? This, that, and the other thing. And so I pressed Gmail. Well, then I get another legitimate looking page, and it said, "We need your Gmail password, and just to send this thing to my email." And I thought, well, that's really odd. I never have to give a password, and I don't. And so I didn't do it. And I got out of that screen, and then I went back to another way of just going to my email, and I got it. I did get the article to my email, but I didn't have to, you know, do a password or anything. But that was, it all looked legit, and I'm thinking something was wrong. So I'm going to be pretty cautious about these little articles and such from now on, I think.
Yeah, I think you're probably right. Giving your password, you don't want to do that.
No, you don't. I mean, I'm glad that was a good measure to stop. I think a lot of the articles, depending upon the source, are what we call clickbait, where they just try and keep pulling you in to click more and more things. And you're so enticed by what you're reading and engaged with that, that we're not really always monitoring where we're navigating. And how we're getting there, but we could easily be clicking on imposter websites that, oh yeah, I want to get to my email, and it's not truly your email, it's an imposter, and you hand over that password and username, and now you've given it up to that scammer. So I'm glad that Liz stopped and didn't recognize that for what it was, but we need to be cautious with some of those rabbit holes that we can easily end up going down.
CJ in Clark County called, couldn't stay with us, but wanted to ask what she can do after having her Facebook account hacked and stolen. She can't get help from Facebook despite many requests. What recourse does CJ have?
This is one of those situations where we've found some success working with Facebook. Takes a lot of steps and measures, but I would encourage CJ to file a complaint with us to see if our assistance can help navigate and be able to get regain that account there. Probably going to need a lot of proof that CJ is really CJ and that account really is theirs, but file that complaint. You can reach out to the hotline at 800-422-7128 or go to the website at datcp.wi.gov.
Okay, datcp.wi.gov. James emailed to ask, do these scammers ever get caught, prosecuted, and punished?
They do. They do. It takes a multi-agency effort. I don't have any recent examples, unfortunately, on the front of mind to provide, but we certainly have worked together. We meet quarterly with the Federal Bureau of Investigation, the Federal Trade Commission, U.S. Postal Inspection Service, other state partners to discuss what's circulating in our state and how we're navigating different cases. Some of the money mules that are out there and the gold bar scams and things. So, yes, we do work together and do end up catching some of these individuals.
Kathy in Mercer. We'll give you a chance now. Hi, Kathy.
Hi, Larry. I just wanted to relay my experience with one of the scams your guest was talking about a few minutes ago, where hackers got into my emails. It started with my first notification was asking, I had a text notification asking, did I attempt this purchase at Walmart? Supposedly coming from my bank, which I had not done. After several attempts to report that, I realized that I wasn't actually calling my bank. And I called the real bank, and they said, no, we didn't send you that. And so it led to every single person I ever emailed with got a phony email that led to asking this person to go buy Amazon gift cards to help me. And then as it went on, you know, I changed my password immediately. And then as it went on, every couple weeks, I thought I had lost my mind because my password didn't work. And eventually, I found out that the scammers could change my password on my email. I had to completely close that email account and start over with a different email. It was 2 months of nightmare.
Oh, boy. And that's probably, you may have heard that before, Michelle.
I have. And Kathy, I'm really sorry that you've experienced that nightmare and that it lasted so long. I'm really glad you were able to reach your friends and family to let them know that this was happening. That becomes one of the most important steps when these account takeovers happen, is to notify friends and family that there has been an account takeover. You're not asking for help or gift cards or them to click a link to go somewhere and look at funny photos and things, because you can really help save others, but it can be real difficult to get things back in control. And sounds like you navigated it really well and with patience.
Yeah. Thank you, Kathy, for sharing your experience. I want to, I noticed that there is, or there was, an animal sales scam, which I guess I couldn't remember hearing about this before. Michelle, your agency received a complaint from a farmer?
We have. We've actually received a couple of them. So we know, you know, many consumers shop on third-party online sales platforms, and these can be things like Facebook Marketplace, Craigslist, eBay, and you can find some really great deals on popular rare items. But scammers use these platforms to take advantage of legitimate shoppers. And in a recent complaint reported to us, a farmer lost $4,000 to a scammer who'd claimed to be selling a flock of sheep but they weren't the only person who got scammed. And actually, just today, I was contacted by a farmer who is being impersonated on Facebook selling sheep as well. So this is continuing on, and they are trying to work to get the fake site taken down because people are being taken advantage of in their business's name. But what happened in this specific case is the listing appeared to look legitimate. They offered to deliver 20 high quality animals to the buyer for a total of $5,000. Well, the farmer responded to the ad and paid the seller, the scammer, $2,000 up front. And days later, the seller claimed that they needed an additional $2,000 to cover veterinary fees. And so the farmer sent that amount as well. When the delivery was delayed, the farmer reached out and was told that the funds had been placed on hold by the seller's bank. And so another payment of $500 could really help out. Well, luckily, the farmer refused at this point. They didn't pay again. They investigated the seller's social media profile and found a street address for the seller's farm. And the farmer contacted that farm and was told that the real owners, that they were being impersonated by a scammer who had stolen money from at least one other person. So the scammer was still actively advertising their fake flock of sheep, and they refused to refund the farmer. So we've gotten involved to see where we can step in and resolve and try and work with Facebook to get that site taken down, so people aren't continued to be taken advantage of. But we see various scams like this with different pets over time, different products. Sometimes it's the purchase of a particular vehicle, maybe a classic car, but there's always all sorts of reasons as to why the product can't be delivered, and more money is required to be paid. When it comes to animals, usually it's feed that needs to be done, but we've seen this scam around farm equipment as well. So no matter what you're buying, we need people to check out the seller, stay on the platform when they're having conversations, and try and use a secure payment method. That might mean the credit card, but it might mean an escrow service. So money is protected until product is delivered and there can be a more even exchange. And if you can, maybe you're in the same community and you can meet and do the exchange at a safe, secure location in person, versus the whole virtual aspect of what's happening here.
Ann in Madison, we'll go to you. Hi, Ann.
Hi. I was just wondering, I don't know if it's a scam or spam calls, but we get anywhere from 6 to 12 daily calls, oftentimes from a person named Skylar and other people, and it's about Medicare. And if you listen for a little bit, they'll ask if you have Medicare A and B, and we hang up. Is there any way to stop those calls? Because the times when I've called back, just, you know, after I've hung up, I'll call the number back, and it's never a connected number. It says, do-do-do-do, the number has been disconnected or something like that.
Yeah. Are you on the do not call list?
Yes, and we say that too.
Yeah. Yeah, okay. Well, there's some unscrupulous people who don't care about the do not call list, Michelle.
That's right. And they spoof their phone number and they misrepresent the phone number they're calling from. So you're copying it down and trying to call it back and you're getting the ketones there. They say that they're from Medicare, but maybe they're just a scammer. Maybe they're a business in trying to sell a product related to Medicare. I would encourage you, Ann, to file a complaint with the information that you are able to obtain, the time the phone call is happening, the number that it's coming from, who they're representing themselves. I'd also encourage you not to try calling anything back. But if you file those complaints with us, maybe there's a way that we can connect some dots behind the scenes to try and identify who's making these calls to you and try and take the action that way through the no-call enforcement mechanism.
And that
you can reach us at the Consumer Protection Hotline at 800-422-7128 or the website at datcp.wi.gov.
800-422-7128 or datcp.wi.gov for you, Ann, or anybody else who's listening. Michelle Reinen, our guest, administrator of the Wisconsin Division of Trade and Consumer Protection. Give a call, the number 800-642-1234. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Looking at consumer scams today with Michelle Reinen. Great to have you listening in today. I know there are some travel-related scams going on out there. If you're planning to leave the country on vacation this spring or summer, should you know about getting or renewing a passport, for example?
Yeah, it's a great question. We certainly want consumers to be able to get those passports so they can travel. And the thing I'm going to say is, go to travel.state.gov. It's the official government website for passport services. What we're seeing is that consumers applying for renewing a passport, they can start with a simple internet search. However, those top results can often lead to websites that seem official, but they're actually run by private companies who charge for services that would otherwise be free. These websites might use official names, flags, and government seals, or claim to have a special relationship with the government. Some can even be outright scams that are soliciting money and personal information, and then they don't provide any services at all. But go to travel.state.gov. There you will find the forms to renew and apply for a passport. They're free. They also do have a list of legitimate companies that are registered with the U.S. Department of State that do charge extra fees to submit applications or pick up passports on consumers' behalf, but they don't provide unique services for faster delivery. Might be a service that someone needs, but that's where you're going to find that official list of companies that are registered to do that service. And so that is the passport side. But the other side of the scams that we're seeing and navigating this in our own household is TSA pre-check scams.
Yeah.
So this is really popular. I'm curious that this is going to become global entry as well, that this will expand to the global entry aspect of it. But some travelers want to speed up that airport experience and get that TSA pre-check. And so scammers take advantage of popular programs, and they're sending emails and text messages and posting online ads offering to enroll and renew users in TSA PreCheck. But when a consumer clicks on these links, they're taken to the scam website designed to, again, steal the money and personal information. And you may not realize that you've done this business with the scammer as opposed to with TSA until you get to the airport and you're ready to use that service. So, first-time applicants, you can't pay online. You can't apply online. You have to make an appointment and pay in person at a TSA enrollment center. So go to tsa.gov/precheck to get the application, make your appointment, and go about that. Now, those who are renewing, who already have the product and they're renewing, you can pay online or you can pay in person, but make sure you're at tsa.gov/precheck when doing any of your business related to a renewal, because you don't want to end up at a scammer's website and have your TSA precheck expire on you.
So that's tsa.gov/precheck for that.
Yes.
Would the global, is that the same?
You can find global entry information here as well. There'll be links to that because I was looking at it myself. So you can certainly, you know, navigate that space as to which product's going to be best for you.
Yeah, I got an email saying that my TSA was up in August or something. And so, and I don't know if that was part of a scam or not, but I'm going to head over to that to get that renewed properly. If you have the global one, do you need the TSA one, the pre-check?
So it's I'm no expert on this travel, but it's my understanding that, no, the global's the larger, and so you won't need the TSA, but the TSA is not the global. So if you're a really frequent international traveler, then global could be right for you. But you have to determine what's frequent. You know, is it 1-2 trips, or can you stand in line for that? And TSA is enough because, you don't get a credit for one towards the other. You're buying over and that sort of thing. But the TSA pre-check, as I understand it, is 5 years, and yours indicates on it when you receive that information what your expiration date is. So even if you get that email reminder, you can go look at your information and verify that, yes, mine is expiring and I should work to renew it in advance versus just responding to the message and maybe clicking a link where you don't belong.
Okay. Let's see. We've got Rick in Marinette County with something. Hi, Rick.
How you doing?
Good.
I'd like to tell you what happened to me one time, about 4 or 5 years ago it was. I have an email address, and then on the email address I got my, I tried to connect my email to my email was, and then it wouldn't let me have any, wouldn't let me get any of my emails. And then a number came up and said, you got to call this number if you want your emails. So I called that number on there, and it says that you got to pay us $350 if you want us to connect your emails again. I said, I'm not going to pay $350. That email's for free. He says, no, it isn't. You've got to pay $350. And so I hung up with him, and then I called, it was a Yahoo email. So I called up the Yahoo carrier itself, and the Yahoo carrier gave me the Yahoo number to call. And I called the Yahoo back, and I got exactly the same guy again. And he said, you're going to get this number every time because it's all coming back to me. But I didn't talk to him again, and I called up the carrier to get the number again for to complain about it. And she said, somehow or other, we got a guy that got our Yahoo number, and he's saying that he wants $350 for your emails back. So what I did is that I just deleted all my Yahoo emails. Went to another carrier.
Wow. That's too bad.
It is. It sounds very complicated as to whatever was happening there. I'm glad he didn't pay the money, found a new way to start over, but somehow seemed to be caught up in a thread scam where was still reaching the scammer each and every time. I think maybe if we'd been around when that was happening live, filing a complaint might have been able to assist in some way in trying to communicate with the legitimate Yahoo to see what we could have done. So if others are experiencing something like that and can't navigate to the correct source, maybe reaching out to consumer protection could provide some assistance.
Yeah. The lawn care season is coming up, and I know you wanted to make a comment or two about spring, and you know, many people hire landscaping services. How do you go about choosing who to hire to do the work?
Yeah, so there's some tips that we have in making the choice, and we have time right now to make those choices. So hopefully everyone can work these tips. And that's first, ask for recommendations. Go to friends and family that may use a lawn care service provider, if that's what you're interested in, or a landscaping company, and ask for those recommendations. You can even go to home shows and see what your options are out there. But then get more than one estimate and make sure they're all bidding on the same job. Have them come to the location, take a look at what it is you want to do, whatever plans and drawings that you have for whatever landscaping it is. But then be sure the same materials are being compared and contrasted so your estimates will make sense. And then ask for names of recent customers and call those customers to see what their experience was with that landscaper or contractor. And did they clean up afterwards? Did they show up on time? Did they follow through on any guarantees or warranties and follow-up work that needed to be done? And then practice caution. If you are considering a door-to-door, there are legitimate businesses that work with municipalities this time of year to solicit door-to-door, but take the time to check them out. Don't just sign a contract on the doorstep because they're offering a one-time deal. You need time to evaluate what it is that the services they're offering and how that's going to work into your plan. And then get everything in writing when you are going to have a service. Maybe it's a repeat service throughout the year. What's the payment plan going to be? What's the service offering and the frequency for that service? And maybe it's a one-time project, but when will it start? When will it end? And get everything all wrapped up.
And on that note, Michelle, I'm sorry we've got so many callers yet to want to visit with you, but we are out of time. Thank you so much for, on short notice, taking the time to be with us today. It's always a pleasure. Good to see you. And we'll be doing this again down the road pretty quick. Thank you, Michelle.
Sounds great. Thanks for having me.
Michelle Reinen, Administrator of the Division of Trade and Consumer Protection within our Wisconsin Department of Ag, Trade, and Consumer Protection. Big thanks to our team today, Claire Neipert, Joel Patnod, Lee Rayburn, and Jeff Robbins, our executive producer, Jill Nadeau. I'm Larry Mueller, and thank you for listening. And please stay with us. Lots more in store here on WPR News.